Blog Talk Radio.
To another edition of Outside Looking In. My name is Bruce Negrin. We're talking about the issues that emanate from Montgomery County. It's Tuesday night. What are you up to? I'll tell you what I'm up to. I'm here talking to you about things. That's right. Our phone number is 773-897-6423. That's 773-897-6423. And the funny part about this show is it doesn't matter what time I get down into the basement. I lock the door, I put the kids to bed, I come down here, and it never, ever wants me to have an easy transition. Always making me nervous, always making me a little bit scared here, because I'm trying to get on the air, and things aren't working. They're never working. Maybe it's the operator. I'm starting to think that. Anyway, this is Outside Looking In. My name is Bruce Negrin, as I mentioned. We're here every Tuesday night from between 8 and 9 p.m., whether the Rangers are on, the Capitals are on, or the Wizards are playing. Speaking of the Wizards, I am going to stop rooting for them. I told you a couple weeks ago that I might start rooting for the Wizards because I enjoyed how John Wall played basketball and how they ran the floor and all of that good stuff. And once I said I was going to do that, guess what happened? They started biting it. Yeah, pretty badly. Exactly. They got blown out by the Hawks. They got blown out by Toronto. Got blown out by everybody. So maybe I'm just going to pull back, pull away from the Washington Wizards and let them enjoy their run and do what they got to do and see if I'm the jinx or not. The only other time I was a jinx was for Penn State. You know, my wife went to Penn State. I'm not a big fan of Penn State, but I started rooting for them once when they were playing Florida State University in the Orange Bowl or something years and years ago. My wife was at the game, so I'm pulling for her. Enjoy, have a good time. Goes into overtime, and Penn State's just losing. So I started rooting for Florida State. Penn State wins. How you doing? That's the way it works. That's the way it is. We're going to talk about a couple things tonight. We've got some important stuff, some unimportant stuff. It depends on how you look at things. And I know there's a couple people out there, like my friend Lenny Block. He's always like, why don't you talk about hockey on the program? Why don't you talk about hockey? Well, tonight we will talk about hockey for a little bit. The Miracle on Ice. Miracle on Ice, 35 years ago. I want to talk about its lingering impact on hockey and on the world itself. I mean, now that you look about all these things, they did a documentary on the Russians and showed the whole Russian side of the Miracle on Ice. You've always seen the part for the USA side where a bunch of college kids get together and have a master motivator in terms of Herb Brooks, their coach, telling them how it's going to be and what they should do and pushing all the right buttons. But we also get to see it from the Soviet side, where the Soviets were professionals. No matter if they were 21 years old or whatever, or 33 years old, you know, they called themselves an amateur team, but they were on, you know, the Red Army. And 11 months a year, they were training, working together, doing everything together. I can't imagine playing hockey for 11 months or being locked away for 11 months. You know, that Russian system must have really sucked. It really did. There's no other way to put it. It's like communism just, it's a nice idea, but when put into practice, and when it's trying to show that you're a dominator of the world, and the Russians, that was their warfare. Hockey was their, you know, foot on the throat of Europe. That's for sure. for all the other countries there, for all the ones, Sweden and Czechoslovakia. They were showing them what they could do. And this is the power of the Russians. I mean, and you could see with Putin coming back, right, riding horses with no shirt on. Also, him, a picture's taken of him playing hockey and just trying to be a manly man. You know, this is Russia. This is what we are. Russia's the Wild West. It scares me a little bit because the currency out there is money. It's money. That's the funny part about all these communistic systems now. You know, all these communist systems, is that it's about money. It's about, you know, it's capitalistic communism. I don't know how you can even put the two together. But look at China, you know, trying to be the industrial power that it is. You got the Russians trying to build back to the industrial power or into the world power that they were. You know, the oil had it for them for a while, but now the market's been flooded. The ruble's nothing. You know, Russia's really a little bit in trouble. But they're trying to flex their muscle anytime they can. Trying to show us, trying to show the world, you know, the Ukraine, you can't take away. They want to be Russian, we're going to go in there and be Russian. But that's the way it was back in 1980, and that's why the Miracle on Ice was so important. You know, people talk about it. If you didn't see the game or if you didn't live in that time, I don't think you can understand the situation the United States was in. You know, it's people talk about it now, how it's pretty dire, and, you know, Obama's nothing, he's a failure, he's this, he's that. You know, and, you know, we got hostages again. There's some parallels. But I don't want to even get into that kind of thing in terms of comparison. Although I did say they're parallels. It's the situation where in 1980, they had the hostages. Iran had the hostages for 400 and some odd days. You know, U.S. was in a gas crisis. Nothing was going right. The Russians just invaded Afghanistan. And, you know, as a side note, as a sidebar here, if there ever, ever was a reason to understand your history and know your history because it's bound to repeat itself. That is example number one within the last 35 years. Afghanistan. I mean, no one can control it. People still in tribes following warlords. You know, and they're trying to build a democracy there. Good luck. It's going to take a long, 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 long time. You know, and just having U.S. presence there just doesn't mean that it's going to work. People look at democracy and think it's easy. Oh, we should have a democratic country. We should have free elections. And maybe, you know, I hope Giuliani doesn't criticize me for not loving America. But when was it? Hezbollah had their elections, or the Palestine had their elections, and they elected Hezbollah. And everyone's like, oh, it's not a fair election. It was a fair election, and it was pretty clean. That's what they wanted. They wanted that. You know, we didn't like it. But that's democracy. If there was a vote and it happened, you're not going to like it. Sometimes you're not going to like it. But democracy is not easy. You know, and there's a sign on the Korean War Memorial in downtown D.C. where freedom is not free. And that's the truth. I mean, sometimes you got to look back and just study it. And that's why history is so important. Because you understand it's just a phrase if you don't look at history, if you don't understand history. But anyway, getting back to 1980, I was in sixth grade at that particular time, so an impressionable young child, not really understanding what's going on in the world. You know, I understood that something happened in Iran. I understood it very well. And, you know, it was like a bad time to be in the U.S. It was a really bad time. Everything that, you know, you see a lot of these movies talking about trying to build the backstory and the pictures and everything that they say for these when they talk about the USA hockey team or the 1980s, that was true. It was absolutely true. It was downtrodden. The U.S. was on the balls of its ass. No kidding about that. So that's why this Miracle on Ice was so important. Like these college kids going up against the Russians, and it gave the country something to rally behind. You know, people didn't care about hockey, but they saw that these kids, literally kids, some of them no more, the oldest guy on the team might have been 26, 27 years old, some of them 25, but they were the youngest team to go to that tournament in Lake Placid, New York. And they got there, they started winning, they tied the first game in overtime. I could tell you everything that happened. I remembered everything that happened. I mean, I was very into hockey at that particular time, but just seen some magic, because I had seen a couple weeks before, or about a week before the Olympics, the Russians played the United States, and the U.S. lost 10-3. It was an afternoon game at Madison Square Garden, so they had it on my cablevision. Remember those old cable boxes where you'd have to get up and click the dials and then click the numbers? Who was the remote in my house? I was the remote. That's the funny part about anybody who's 40, 45 years old, 47 years old. When cable first came in, or before they had remote control, you know who was the clicker? The youngest kid in the family, he was the clicker. Click, click, click. That is that good? No, keep going. Click, click, click. It was a better job than being the antenna, that's for sure. We had to hold on to the antenna part and to have some tinfoil in your other hand. It was a much better part than that. But particular time, I knew it was going on. The Rangers were just finished the 78-79. They went to the Stanley Cup Final, so I was big into hockey. And I was really rooting for this team, watching them. And I remember sitting on my dad's bed, because they played the game at 5:30, and the game came on a tape delay. But it was the worst secret ever kept in the United States. Because my brother bounds up the stairs. My brother's 3.5 years older than me. He's like, you won't believe it! And he's hysterical. Hysterical, I tell you. I'm like, Eric, what's wrong? What's the matter? What's the matter? He goes, we won! And I'm like, what do you mean we won? Because we beat the Russians. We beat the Russians. And I'm like, no way we beat the Russians. Because I haven't seen them play. They played hockey like no one played hockey before. Back and forth passing, tic-tac-toe. It was awesome, incredible, beautiful. Especially for North American people who didn't know how to play that way, up and down the wing, not knowing what's going on. But it was beautiful hockey, and it was totally unexpected. A week before, the United States lost 10-3, and they beat the Russians. And what's amazing about that is that I'm sure you, like I, sat there at 8:30 and watched the game, and you knew the outcome, and you didn't believe it. You didn't believe the outcome, because you didn't know how it broke down. You just knew that they beat the Russians, and you just were curious to know, how did this happen? I remember grabbing onto a pillow and having it under my chin, which is still the thing I do now when I get nervous, but sitting there in disbelief, not knowing. And then Mark Johnson scores that goal to make it 2-2 at the end of the first. They take out Tretiak, the best goalie in the world. And then they keep it going. And then Eruzione scores that goal. And it was just at the end, the excitement, the joy, the absolute joy of beating the Russians. The Russians were in disbelief. They couldn't believe it. That's what disbelief means. But they sat there and they're just like, wow. Wow. That's why you have to dream. That's why you have to follow through on your plan. Because anything can happen with effort and work and a belief, more so a belief in something than anything else. If you can believe it can be done, at least you're going to give an effort that's out of your mind. And the Americans did on that day. But the whole thing that everybody forgets, just not beating the Russians, but that was wonderful. But the United States could have not meddled. If they did not beat Finland, they were either going to get the gold medal or nothing. The gold medal or nothing. So they were playing Finland at like 9 o'clock on a Sunday, a day and a half later, a day later. One of those strange times, and they're losing again. And Herb Brooks had one of the best lines of all time in terms of motivation. Unfortunately, he had a couple curse words in there, but he was talking to the team, and they were losing 2-1 going into the third. He walks out. He walks into the room. He goes, "You're blowing this, guys. You're blowing it." He goes, "You lose this game, you'll take it to your bleeping grave." He walks out of the room. Everybody's looking at him like, wow, that's pretty impactful. He comes back into the room. He goes, "To your bleeping grave," and then walks out again. Gives me chills. I'm like, yeah, let's go. Let's do it. Yeah. So the Americans won the gold medal, and these guys will walk together for the rest of their lives. They'll walk together for another 30 years just because of the impact. They said it was a hockey game, and it was much more than a hockey game. It was a battle. It was a hockey game on that sheet of ice in Lake Placid. But what it did for the United States, how it rallied the country, how it made people believe again. It is one of those times where you talk to people from the Great Depression and they talk about, you know, oral history. This is something that I'll tell my kids. When we were watching it the other day, I said, this was the greatest sports moment of my life. And it happened when I was 8 or 9 years old, if you could believe it. 8 or 9 years old. But it was so important. From there, Reagan got elected. The hostages were freed. America bounced back. The Berlin Wall got torn down. Russia's dabbled with democracy. Life-changing. Absolutely life-changing. Everything that you knew and everything that you believed the enemy were the Russians. The enemy. They still might be. You know, don't ever sleep on the Russians. That's the one thing you got to understand. Don't ever sleep on them because they might be tamed right now, but they're looking to get an edge as well, especially with Putin there. You know, everyone's like, oh, I looked into the souls of his eyes, the windows of his eyes, soul, or whatever. And I saw a good man, a man, you know, come on. That was the head of the KGB. Untold evil lurks in the shadows of men. This is Outside Looking In. My name is Bruce Negrin. I'll stop boring you with the hockey stuff. My phone number is 773-897-6423. That's 773-897-6423. The program is called Outside Looking In, and I'm here every Tuesday night talking about issues that emanate from North Potomac, from Gaithersburg, from Rockville, from Bethesda, from Montgomery County, Maryland, and beyond. I had to pay a nod to the Olympics, to the USA team. It was just necessary. But I also want to talk about what's going on in Montgomery County right now. So Montgomery County and the state have so many transportation programs going on that it's crazy. You know, and the whole key is, just like Kevin Costner in the film Field of Dreams, if you build it, the question, though, is if you build it, will he will come? The question is, if you build it, will they come? Will they use it? There are a couple projects running around that are going to have an impact on the area that we know as North Potomac and Gaithersburg, the Muddy Branch area, the Travilla Road area, Bellwood Farm, up to Great Seneca. There's a meeting tomorrow, which if you have the opportunity to go to, unfortunately I don't. But they're going to be talking about, it's a meeting to discuss the Corridor Cities Transitway, the CCT, and how it may impact you. They're going to be talking to Rick Kegel, the CCT project manager, how it's going to impact North Potomac, Maryland. It's going to be Wednesday, February 25th at 7 p.m. at Stone Mill Elementary School, and that's on Stonebridge View Road in North Potomac. It's important that you go out there. If you have any questions, these little meetings that come around that no one pays attention to are probably the most important thing that you can do in civic service and civic duty to yourself and to your neighbors. Because it's at these meetings that plans get laid out. It's at these meetings that questions get answered. Questions get asked, more importantly, and hopefully they get answered. Let me rephrase that. Because sometimes people will try to skirt the issue. They'll just make the presentation and poof, gone. But this is a pretty impactful situation because what they're doing here, they're talking about running buses. Buses from the Shady Grove Metro Center. And then they're going to start running it to, where is it, Washington Grove up in, or Metropolitan Grove up in like Clarksburg. This thing is a big fishhook. It's going from the Shady Grove, going to go all the way down into, because what they're really trying to promote here, what they're really trying to promote is this life sciences center down on off of Shady Grove and Great Seneca. This is supposed to be the future of Montgomery County, at least the way they portray it. And they are making a lot of plans for transportation to be there. The thing is, well, let's read what it's about. We need to know the purpose. This is from Scale It Back, a lady called Donna Barron. I'm getting a couple of emails from her, so she speaks. I just want to put out what her side is. I should be at this meeting tomorrow to hear Mr. Kegel talk and find out what their side is. But right now, I've been driven around and being down here. This is what I have a different look, I say outside looking in. Because I've been coming down to this area before I moved down here for about 10 or 12 years. We have a good friend who lived down here. So we would come down, and I'd see all this development coming on. And I talked about this last week. And Bellwood Farm amazed me. I always wondered how that holdout was there. How could they have all this development going on and someone's holding out right there? Well, I found out that it really wasn't a holdout. It's just a slow build. But anyway, that Bellwood Farm, they're going to build on that. And because of that, it's Life Science Center, the Bellwood. What they want to do there is build, and build pretty high now. Johns Hopkins has the property. It was supposed to be sparse and low. Now it's going to be dense and high. Johns Hopkins wants to do. They want to build. They want to use this property and maximize it. I understand. But, you know, you got to build within the scale of a neighborhood. I guess there's no real neighborhood around that. But you're going to put a city, you're going to put a city inside or very close to, across the street, no doubt, from residential neighborhoods. And neighborhoods that have been here since 1987 or so. Not that that makes them grandfathered in, but it's a long way. So this property is important. But anyway, this is what the meeting is going to be about. They're going to ask the questions such as knowing what the purpose of the CCT bus system is and how the city and city, county, and state will mitigate the potential problems. Here's the question. The usefulness of this very expensive project is still up in the air. That's the scary part about it. The president of the Clarksburg Chamber of Commerce announced at the meeting regarding the Independent Transit Authority, which we talked about, that Ike Leggett tried to put through, that the people of Clarksburg will not ride the CCT bus. Is that a shocker? Is that a surprise to you? You know, you must condition people, and we've talked about this numerous times, about conditioning, about how Rudy Giuliani conditioned people into stepping away from the subway and being nicer in Manhattan. Broken windows theory thing. Manhattan was lost, and he got it back. So whatever he says now, I will have a special place in my heart for that guy because he was able to bring New York City back. New York City, New Yorkers can't live in New York City anymore. That's how good it's become. That's how nice it's become. They got a Bubba Gump Shrimp Company in Times Square, an Olive Garden in Times Square. New Yorkers don't eat there. It's for all you tourists that go there that eat there. Oh, look, Bubba Gump Shrimp Company. I remember that movie. Woo! Woo! I love it. I love it. Let's get some shrimp. Very frustrating. Taking out my pizza places for your Bubba Gump Shrimp. But anyway, Times Square has become Disney-fied, if so to speak. If you will, excuse me. You know, and it's become very corporate, and it's a nice place to work. It used to be gritty, grimy, nasty. And I hate the people, or the people who say, oh, it was better that way, make me laugh. They make me laugh because it wasn't better. It was scarier. It was grittier for sure. But people have this love affair with New York City. Saying, oh, you know, it was my city. They took away my city. Brother, they took it away. Yeah, they did take it away. They took away the drug peddling on every corner. When I was a kid, I used to come in from New Rochelle, go past the library on Fifth Avenue on my way to Times Square. If you could believe it, maybe I'll show you a webcast one day. Maybe I'll put a picture on our website or on our Facebook page, and you'll get to see me. I was a child model, if you could believe it. I used to do photo shoots with my man Ricky Schroeder, a child model, Bruce Negrin child model. So my mom used to take me into the city. So I had an early indoctrination into New York City, and there was a guy on the corner of Fifth Avenue right at the New York Public Library, beautiful building, beautiful Bryant Park. Bryant Park was scary. You go ice skating in there now. You watch movies on the grass. It's wonderful. But it was scary. Again, 1980, right? It all comes full circle, baby. All comes full circle. Everything gets tied in this program. I might go off on tangents to the left and right, but it all comes back. But a guy used to walk by. We walked by this one guy. He had in his hands, he had both of his hands wrapped around maybe 100 joints. And he'd be like, smoke. I'm in sixth grade. You're offering me marijuana. You out of your mind? That's a good city? That's the city you want it to be? I don't dig Olive Garden. I don't mind some nice restaurants. I wish Mom and Pop were doing it. Or maybe some of these New York City chains, you know, inside the New York City restaurant groups. I'd rather have them there than Bubba Gump Shrimp Company. But don't tell me New York City was a better place. It had more character. Sure it did. Absolutely. But at what cost? That's the whole thing you got to ask yourself sometimes. At what cost? The quality of life was not good. It was not good. You know, when they show these period pieces on Netflix, you know, in 1970s, I'm a sucker for old 1970s movies in New York. I'm a sucker for old-time New York books like Caleb Carr, you know, Jack Finney and a couple others. I love reading about old New York. And whether it's in the 50s, 1890s, The Alienist was Caleb Carr. That's a great book. Go read that one. Whether it's the 50s, the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, it's awesome. It's awesome. There's going to be a series coming out on Netflix, too, now, coming up about how hip-hop got started in the Bronx. Hip-hop. Not rap. Hip-hop, the whole thing. Now it's all just rap music. Now it all stinks. That should be interesting. I'll tell you, though, if you go to Netflix, I got to tell you something. I got a good treadmill. I go on the treadmill and or the elliptical or something like that. I put on Netflix on my phone, and I've been watching a program right now called The Men Who Built America. It's off of the History Channel, but it's on Netflix. What a fascinating series. Fascinating. Talking about Rockefeller and Vanderbilt and Carnegie. But Rockefeller, there was something that... Okay, I'm going to jump ahead a bit, and then I'm going to get back to this corridor city. Did you know that Cornelius Vanderbilt created John Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil? Created him. He brought him into New York from Ohio, said, because Vanderbilt knew that he needed product to keep his trains profitable. So he went to Rockefeller, said, well, sure, I'll do that, signed a deal, had to mortgage himself pretty much, and put everything at risk, which is the key factor here. All these guys put them all themselves at risk to have such great success. But he put himself at risk to get up to that production. So then he started filling the trains, and then he realized he was doing Vanderbilt a favor. And Vanderbilt had better terms. So another railroad baron came to him, John Scott, said, I want to take your oil, and I'll give you a better price. So he worked Rockefeller, jumped ship, went to with John Scott. And then all of a sudden, the railroads all got together, the monopoly aspect got together, and they said, hey, Rockefeller's running, taking our shirt here. We're losing money. Even though he's filling our trains, he's got his terms are too favorable. So they cut him. They all bounded together. The enemies of the railroad bound together, and they said to Rockefeller, here are the terms. Rockefeller got so mad, created a pipeline. So John Rockefeller, I'm not sure, and I will check this, but I believe he's the first one to start building oil pipelines. So he started moving his oil via pipeline, and the railroads, they did it. And that's where all of these railroads started collapsing, and they just didn't, moving the people wasn't enough. They still needed cargo, and that's why cargo trains are still so important today. But anyway, that was a digression. That wasn't a tangent. So the people of Clarksburg are not going to ride the CCT bus, according to the head of the Chamber of Commerce. The alignment is in a big circle, and once people know how long it will take to go anywhere, their enthusiasm for the CCT bus fades. That's the truth. You know, a bus, if a bus is going to get stuck at all the lights, I know it's rapid, but they're still got to be stuck at lights. I mean, how are they going to cross intersections without being stuck at the same lights that we are? There's going to be no bus crossing. And it just doesn't seem like it goes anywhere. It goes from one station, Washington Grove, over to Shady Grove. And it's going to hit up, you know, East Gaither, West Gaither, Crown Farm. Put on my glasses for this. Life Science Center, Central, Universities at Shady Grove, then up to Bellward, all the way up Shady Grove. And they're going to run it along Shady Grove, where they're going to take down 100 and or some odd, you know, mature trees to build a bus lane after it goes into the Kentlands, and then it's going to get up onto Muddy Branch as well. And it's going to add, you know what it's going to add? It's going to add some stoplights, and you know how I feel about stoplights. Hate them. They're going to have 4 stoplights within a half mile. Talk about you know, you're moving everybody else. You might be moving some people on this bus system, but you're going to slow down everything else. And they'll figure out some other way. They'll make Muddy Branch six lanes. You know, widening streets in certain areas is not always the answer. And if you got the things to do, do the low-hanging fruit. Fix the things that are going to make traffic better right now, like that corner on Riffleford. Build in a right turn lane there. That will free up some traffic. That'll make people get home better. People in Poolsville will love it. People in Germantown will love it. You know, simple fixes. Simple fixes that'll make people's lives better. But, you know, they got it down here. They go for the whole enchilada. Let's build this whole four-door city's transitway. To what avail? To what expense? Because people are not going to ride the bus. There is a stigma with buses. What kind of tangent are you going to want now? And there's a stigma with buses. People do not want to ride the bus. When you are in an accessible car area, people will not ride the bus. Because there's a stigma to it. They think it's for poor people. The bus is not a transportation for me. I'm not going to stand out there at a bus stop in the rain waiting. I have a car. Why do I have to share this ride with everybody? Especially to places I don't know where it's even going. You know, that might be a classist and an elitist look at it, but sometimes you got to take a real look at it. You have to take a real look. This is not Manhattan. This is not an east-west grid situation, a north-south east-west grid situation. When you have that, the bus is fantastic. I appreciated the bus as much as the subway. I'll tell you, when I didn't have time, when I had nowhere to go after work, I would take the bus home, the M20. I would take it from Church Street in Lower Manhattan, just by Broadway. And all you people are like, why are you so particular? Why are you so specific about this? I don't know a damn thing about Manhattan. Why are you talking about that? But anyway, I would take the bus from there to the West Village. It was beautiful. I loved it. The bus above ground. But it took forever. New York City bus took forever. We had to pass through the Canal Street, which was one of the tunnels. There's the Lincoln and the fading from New York. I'm fading. My memories of New York are fading. Help me. Holland. Bam. Thank you. Thank you, brain. The Holland Tunnel. So we have to pass by that. And the train, the bus just took forever. It just took forever. Because the bus is relying on traffic. Even if you're going to make, you know, speedy zones and dedicated bus lanes, there's still going to be people in there. There's still going to be accidents. There's still going to be everything. The bus is not the end all. The bus is a people mover, but when you start extending it over, I don't even know how long, over 40, 50 miles, how many buses are you going to have to run? And buses are expensive. You know, they're talking about the Purple Line also, going from Shady Grove over to Prince George's County, close to the University of Maryland or so. The train is quicker or is more expensive to build, but it's easier to maintain. Buses, you're always going to have to replace. There's always a wear and tear on the bus that is much more severe than on a train. That's a fact, Jack. It is a fact. But this bus thing, it's really, and they asked, I think it was in the Washington Post the other day, I was looking over the Purple Line, and they asked a legit question. They said, okay, if they build the Purple Line, will you ride it? I guess it depends on who you have to go after and who you're talking to. But out of 1,000 people, only like 25% said yes. And it was overwhelmingly no, or I would never even think about it. Not no that they don't want to or against it, but no, it's not part of my daily commute. It won't be part of my daily commute. And the transportation off of these bus systems, you have to spread it out, because transit-oriented development, which they say they're trying to do here, they're missing the point of what it is. Transit-oriented development is not the life sciences center. You're not near any transit, even if you build a CCT. Even if you build it, you're still, the way it looks to me, I mean, unless they're going to let them run red lights, which they're not, it still looks like you're going to be 25 minutes away from the Life Sciences Center. And that's being generous, I believe. You want to start building businesses. You want to start having people take public transportation. You got to build around the metro stations. That's where your transit is, because people will take metro, especially if they can go from Bethesda to Shady Grove. So you can't really build there. You're going to have to build tunnels or build over it. And that's expensive, but if that's where you have to build to have transit-oriented development. You know, there's Crown up here in Gaithersburg, and inside one of their e-cards, which they hand out, it's a little fold-out pocket brochure saying why Crown, maintenance to Crown is perfect, they have the metro in there. But you're not that close to Shady Grove. You know, that's a pretty long bus ride. Because there's nothing direct. I guess you could get on 370 and get off there and save a couple minutes. But you got to run a dedicated bus for that. And a dedicated bus is only going to start carrying 10 people. You got to start conditioning people. And that's the thing that I don't understand down here. It's not going to happen. This is Henry Ford Model T land. People want to drive. You could say I'm wrong, but I'm not. People want to drive. They don't want to take public transportation if they don't have to. Going to a hockey game tomorrow night. And listen to this. This is from a friend of mine. Going to a hockey game. The red line at Shady Grove goes right to the Caps. Goes right to the Verizon Center. You let out right by the Verizon Center. Someone said, hey, are we going to take Metro? And the guy's response is, nah, it's not that reliable. You know, I don't. It's going to take longer, and it's not that reliable. We could split the garage down there, and we're going to drive. We'll get home a lot quicker. Argument over. This is a guy who grew up in the area. Who knows? All right? This isn't some New Yorker talking or whatever. Because I'm thinking, I always think that maybe I will go up to Shady Grove and take the train to Washington, D.C. Especially if it's a direct route. But who knows with the track changes and all of this kind of stuff? I had friends, it's like, I've gotten stuck. I went out in Bethesda. I was down in D.C. when I was visiting. I went out to see some friends in Bethesda. They dropped me off back at the Bethesda train station. I guess it was 12 o'clock. It was a Thursday, 11 o'clock. I don't even know what time it was, but it was closed. Closed. The train station is closed. Unless you're running a 12-hour system, a 13, 14-hour system, people aren't going to take it because they don't believe in it. New York City, you take the subway everywhere you go. For one reason, it's fast. Most of the time, it's fast. You catch it at late night, you're almost scared because you feel like you're going 50 miles an hour on that track. You just hope that the conductor's sober. No, that's a disparaging remark, and I strike that from the record, sir. But no, I mean, it's fast. Metro, nothing fast about it. There doesn't seem to be any urgency on Metro about where to go. And there were some train lines in New York like that as well. But the point being is that people don't believe in it. People don't believe in taking Metro. They believe in driving, and good luck. Good luck with that campaign. Instead of spending money on bus routes that really don't go anywhere, trying to get people to get on them, spend some money conditioning people to say, you need to take this. Give them a reason to take it. Another thing is, how do you get on a ride-on bus? How are you going to get on these buses? I don't even know how to take a bus in Montgomery County. Is there a special card? Can I pay with cash? Is there a token? I know there's no token. But is it direct or exact change? I guess I could read a website, but promoting that as well would be pretty interesting because a lot of people were not going to be looking up a website for Metro and Ride On and all of that stuff. Building something for the sake of building is not worth it. Laying out a plan for the sake of saying that you have transit going somewhere is not worth it if it's not going to be used. And I have a feeling it's not going to be used. The one thing that they didn't mention in this article that I or the that was given to me, this email that I received, is how long it would take to go on a circuitous route. I don't know. I mean, you just got to face reality sometimes. Yeah, you can push it. Yeah, you can try it. Good for you. I mean, I get thinking going on, transit, that's the future. But if no one's going to, you got to condition people, and everyone's like, oh, I don't want government in my face. I don't want this. I don't want that. But how is it going to work? If you think I'm wrong, give me a call. If you think I'm wrong, give me a call. Program's called Outside Looking In with Bruce Negrin. That is me. I am Bruce Negrin. I'm here every Tuesday talking about the issues that emanate from Montgomery County and beyond. I want to hear your take on it. I know you're out there listening. I can track the calls. I know who's listening live. I know who's been listening on the archives. Give me a call. I want to hear what you have to say. The phone number is 773-897-6423. That's 773-897-6423. And in the recent weeks, I also put up something. I put up a Facebook page. How about that? How about that for ego? I got a Facebook page now. On Facebook, it's called Outside Looking In with Bruce Negrin. And my Facebook page is www.facebook.com/Bruce Negrin Radio. The reason this is important, because all the stuff that I talk to you about, all the articles, most of the articles that I talk to you about are on the Facebook page. And there you can get further in depth and see if I'm crazy or if I'm lying. Or if I'm so dead on that it just blew your mind right there, like Kramer. Jerry. Jerry. Levels. Levels, Jerry. Levels. What else is going on in Montgomery County? Well, here's something interesting. This isn't from Montgomery County, but there was something that I read in the newspaper again, and you might be shocked. They're talking about digital books versus print books, but the choice is clear, at least for one group. Is it the baby boomers? I would say so. Is it Generation X? I would say so. I don't even know this generation stuff. I'm sitting around 47 years old. I have no idea what generation I'm in. I mean, somebody tell me. I mean, what am I supposed to be into? What is my thing? I don't think I'm Generation X. I know I'm not a millennial. I don't know why I'm not a millennial, but I just know it. But anyway, the millennials prefer printed books over digital stuff. What? Yes. Textbook makers, bookstore owners, and college student surveys all say millennials still strongly prefer print for pleasure and learning, a bias that surprises reading experts given the same group's proclivity to consume most other content digitally. Is that really a surprise? Is that really a surprise? It is easier to read a book in hand than it is to read a book online. The only advantage to me about reading a digital book is because I'm a big sucker. I read The Power Broker by Robert Caro, and it was about Robert Moses. I've read about two or three books that have had 1,000 or 1,500 pages. Carrying those books in your book bag or making room for it, moving your lunch over when you're going to work so you could carry a 1,000-page book is terrible. I hate it. Hate it. But the people who read in the books, the millennials now and people in college, they say it's less of a distraction. You know, they like the book because they can feel it. They can read it. There's no distractions to it. Because someone was in this article was talking about, yeah, if I read a book on a phone or on my Nook or something like that, you know, I finish a paragraph. This talk about lack of discipline. But they finish a paragraph, and then they check Facebook for a half hour. So what should have been time for reading got wasted. But there is a purpose for digital. Don't get me wrong on this. Because this is what they said, and I totally agree. When did students say they prefer digital books? They prefer it for science and math classes, whose electronic textbooks often include access to online portals that help walk them through study problems and monitor their learning. Textbook makers are pushing these digital learning environments to make screen learning more attractive. Doesn't that sound like leapfrog to you? What you give your kids? Leapfrog? here, here's an enhanced book. Here's I could see the purpose. I could see it. I mean, if you're going to build in these websites and build in the models and the breakdowns, that's where you can get a little bit better, but especially for math. If you go into math, I would like to see how something's built. I mean, geometry, calculus, something like that, you could see the theory or see how it's written. I'm for that. But also, the thing about digital books is that the price is much, much cheaper. You know, and then plus you could swap them if you're smart enough to know how to steal them. They're pirating. Bad news. Bad news. Used to be a thing when I worked for the recording industry. I worked for a record company. That's how old I am, a record company. Not the music industry. Not even the recording industry, a record company. But being in the rap music side of it, we used to get a lot of knockoffs. People used to do a lot of bootleg tapes. So you walk around, you see an album that hadn't even come out yet from your label. You're like, how the heck did it get on this Nigerian guy's blanket or table at the corner of Houston and the whatever? How is it out there already? See, what they used to say, end piracy. The artist doesn't get any money for anything. People didn't care about the artist. Obviously, the artist cares about the artist, but people don't care about the artist. Oh, I could get something for $5. But what you were buying was garbage. That's the problem with bootleg anything. Most of the time, you're getting garbage. That's why you shouldn't buy it, because it's not worth the $5. You know, you see those movies on the corner or at a street fair or something, all this knockoff. You know, you'll never see that guy from the street fair again. It's like Zoltor from Big. One day he's in New Jersey, the next day he's at Rye Playland. Tom Hanks has to, you know, they have to do a gaming search to find Zoltor, because you'll never find this guy. The only thing to buy at a street fair, the only thing I buy at a street fair is brown dress socks. Actually, because the street fairs have brown athletic socks. You want to go into business, do me this, all right? A lot of people have these Skechers sneakers now and all these fancy sneakers. I got a pair of brown shoes, casual shoes. Brown, mind you. I want to wear brown socks. And I don't want to wear light brown socks in the wintertime. Make some dark brown athletic socks that you could sell at Modell's or Dick's. And that way I could wear them, and I think you'd make a fortune. I should be doing this. What am I giving you my idea? Something comfortable to wear in your Skechers or your Timberlands or something like that that still match. I was talking to a friend of mine, Brian Tercero, and we were talking about that. It's exactly. It's like with a suit sometimes, I still wear the Wilson socks. I know it's not very hip, but it might be hip. Who knows? Everybody does something so stupid now. We all dress so stupidly sometimes that it might be hip. I might be a trendsetter. But if I'm going to be on my feet all day at a trade show or something, I'm wearing some comfortable socks. I'm no fool.
I pity the fool who don't wear comfortable socks. I pity him. I pity Balboa. He's so predictable, he's stupid.
Again, 1980s. Rocky fighting Drago. It all comes full circle. It all comes full circle. So what's going on with ridiculousness? Well, I'm not going to talk about ridiculousness yet. I'm going to leave that for the end. But there is an interesting study, a very interesting study that just came out, saying allergy study supports early introduction of peanuts. What does this have to do with Montgomery County? It has everything to do with Montgomery County if you have a kid in school. Peanuts are like heroin. And I'm not trying to make fun of people who have peanut allergies. I can't imagine having it. It must stink. Got to keep an epidural pen with you. Peanut will clog up your throat. Just traces of it. I mean, there's some school in Bethesda I was reading in this article that makes all parents wipe their faces and hands with Purell and Purell towelettes in case there was a trace of peanut butter on you, a trace of peanut. I mean, if it's that serious, come on. Crazy. But anyway, peanut allergies on an occasionally life-threatening condition that has prompted changes in food consumption rules in settings as varied as preschools and airplanes can be sharply reduced by feeding peanut products to children at risk for the ailment beginning when they are infants. This is what research reported in a major study on Monday. The findings could have implications for other potentially dangerous childhood allergies, such as those involving milk and eggs. And if follow-up research shows the approach is safe, this might be a way to slow the rapid increase of peanut allergies, experts say. I mean, it's amazing. That is amazing. I hope I can find this stat. Because if you thought that peanut allergies, if you're one of these people who's like, where the hell did the peanut allergy come from? I went to, 35 years ago, 40 years ago when I'm in school, we didn't know anybody who had a peanut allergy or was allergic to eggs or milk or anything. Hay fever, that's always been around. Allergies were stuffy nose and you can't go outside when there's pollen weed or something. But now it's all these food allergies. And you think that, did they just jump exponentially now? Yes, they did. It came out of nowhere in the last few years. I got to find this number. But feeding peanuts now, peanut products. Oh, this is lack of research on my part because it was very important that I tell you. But the study shows introduction 1.9 peanuts even pediatrics. Sorry, folks, this is important. Oh, here we go. According to the journal's editorial, the prevalence of peanut allergy has quadrupled in the United States in the past 13 years, from 0.4% in 1997 to 2% in 2010. Did you hear that? If it could quadrupled. This is the stuff that's got to change. Because you know what? When we were less worried about germs and less worried about vaccination and less worried about being parents and being helicopter parents and doting on our children over everything, there were cures in our cures. It's natural, right? I mean, things are natural. I'm sure there's a cure for cancer somewhere on this earth. Someone just hasn't figured it out yet. It's like Captain Kirk when he had to beat that lizard guy. All the elements were there for him to beat the lizard guy until he was going around. He's like, diamonds, coal, this, that. He found stuff to make gunpowder and a rocket to beat the lizard guy who had more strength than Captain Kirk. But it was all organic. My point here, again, I am not criticizing people who have these allergies. They're real and they're dangerous and you've got to be careful. But we got to stop protecting our kids. We got to stop. This is the problem with the internet. There are no more secrets. One person has a blog. Listen to my blog. I'm Mom of the Year. So I didn't feed Junior peanuts for a long time. Now they're saying that's the reason. Maybe you should start feeding them a little bit of peanuts, peanut butter, peanut-based something. There's too much information going on in this world. There's too much information that can be misconstrued, and people love to misconstrue things. Oh, guess what I read on the internet? I laugh when someone says that. I laugh. Because who knows what's been vetted on the internet? Nothing. Who knows? This isn't a rant about the internet. But it is a rant that, it's like, seriously, I was talking to my wife. It's like, peanut allergies. Did you have any kids with peanut allergies back in 1975? No. Did you have them in 1980? No. Quadrupled from 1997 to 2010. In 13 years, it quadrupled from 0.4% to 2%. So you are not wrong. If you thought about peanut allergies and not knowing a kid, if you're 47 years old, 50 years old, 43 years old, 30 years old, 35, if you did not know a kid with peanut allergies, you didn't know them. You weren't wrong. They weren't hiding. Somebody had it, but it wasn't prevalent like it is today, and it wasn't a lockdown like it is today. Mr. Peanut is doing a jig. He's dancing. He's like, with his monocle falling out of his face. He's like, zoinks, just eat peanuts. Don't avoid them. I hope it's true. I hope this study is true. I hope we can get rid of peanut allergies because it's not fair. It's not fair. I don't want anybody to die. I don't want anybody to suffer. But if I have a trace of peanut butter on my hand somewhere because I had a peanut butter sandwich, I have to go through a chemical shower because I had a peanut butter sandwich, where's the fairness for you? Where's the fairness for us? Food allergies suck. All right, that's the whole thing. There's nothing to say about it, but other than that. But where's the fairness? And speaking of fairness, speaking of fairness, State line, Virginia. Richmond, state capital. Bake sales are banned. You hear this one? The 4 minutes left in the program. The program's called Outside Looking In. My name is Bruce Degren. Legislators in Virginia seek reprieve for school bake sales. Michelle Obama, in her push for new federal guidelines that took effect this year, banned bake sales from schools because they say it adds too much fat. Fatty fats in our schools. Can't have a bake sale. Let me tell you about bake sales. Bake sales are synonymous with Election Day. Bake sales are synonymous with the PTA. Bake sales are synonymous with schools. To ban them because you say that they make people fat or they don't fall in the federal guidelines of what food should be able to be served in school now is out of your mind. Out of your mind. Donuts are out. Whole wheat muffins in. And Virginia's General Assembly is fed up. It wants to bring back the old sugary school bake sale. Federal guidelines that took effect this year have banished sales of nutritionally dubious treats to students during school hours. Anything sold while school is in session must meet the same nutritional guidelines as school lunches and breakfast. Talk about overstepping your reach and your boundaries. Please. I mean, and they're talking about this Virginia Assembly and the Senate. They're going nuts. They're going nuts. It's part of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. You could get exceptions from that. But the Virginia Board of Education doesn't want to do exceptions. Everyone's in favor of the kids eating healthy, said Bell. I don't know who Bell is, but we're going to pass that over. But he said the new rules pretty much did away with the bake sale type fundraising that many kids relied on to pay for their band uniforms and field trips for students. Everybody found that money to be useful. You know, they're arguing with each other in Virginia about this. Listen to this. Virginia's Senate Minority Leader Richard L. Sazlow warned colleagues to vote against the bill unless you believe America is just not fat enough. Policymakers are yelling, kids are getting fat. Meanwhile, this lady, Petula Dvorak of the Washington Post, she goes, the real culprits include shorter recess, gallons of sugary drinks, insane fast food consumption, video games, electronic gadget addiction, and the fear of letting kids play outside on their own. She's right. She's absolutely right. The bake sale. Let me tell you. I mean, they said, well, let's substitute the bake sale for, you know, we'll sell T-shirts or oven mitts instead. You got to put money in to buy the T-shirts than to sell them. Got to make sure, you know, who's got $10 instead of a dollar? And a bake sale is one of these things that's quick. That's just ridiculous. I am all for nutritional and healthy meals. Get rid of vending machines and soda in schools. Yes, I agree with that. Do not make chocolate cake part of a school lunch. Do not make cookies part of a school lunch. When I was in elementary school or junior high school, I used to go to the Lady in the Cage, get some cookies and a pretzel after I ate my healthy lunch anyway. I was only 150 pounds back then, but that was all right. But anyway, this is how ridiculous rules can get and how people do not see how laws can go down the road and affect everybody. Bake sales. Can't have a bake sale. Can't sell a cookie that costs your mom $1.50 to make, and then you make $10, $15 off of those cookies so you can get new school uniforms or help the PTA build a new jungle gym. Outrageous, ridiculous, unbelievable. My name is Bruce Negrin. The program is called Outside Looking In. Hope to catch you next week. We're here every Tuesday. Do me a favor. Do me a favor. Do something today that'll make it better tomorrow.